Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Tammy Carver. Welcome to the John Carver Show. My husband has helped thousands of people around the world lead happier and more successful lives. Whether you're just beginning to lay your foundation or you've already built your life but need to shore up some weak spots, this show will help you.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
So the title of the text today I'm calling Go Back and Face It. Go Back and Face It. And I think in my life, and I would only assume it's in your life too, that there are times when you want to run away from your destiny, that you want to run away from something that maybe you were born to do. Although over a period of years, some of us have been afraid of doing what we were born to do for a variety of reasons. And the enormity of what you feel that you need to do pulls you in a direction that causes some of us deep, deep terror. Have you ever felt like that you need to do something, or at least climb a mental mountain, or to attempt a certain sport, or attempt to take a certain class? And sometimes it's terrifying because you realize the enormity of what you're trying to accomplish. There was once a bad guy who committed a crime because, you know, that's what criminals do. They commit crimes. And anyway, he was sent to the king for his punishment. The king told him he had a choice of two punishments. He could be hung by a rope or take what's behind the big, dark, scary iron door. So the criminal quickly decided on the rope. As the noose was being slipped on him, he turned to the king and asked, "By the way, out of curiosity, what's behind that door?" The king laughed and he said, "You know, it's funny. I offer everyone the same exact choice, and nearly everyone picks the rope." "So," said the criminal, "tell me what's behind the door." "I mean, obviously I won't tell anyone," he said, pointing to the noose around his neck. The king paused and he answered, and he said, "Freedom. But it means most people are so afraid of the unknown that they immediately take the rope." How many of us have chosen to leave certain doors closed in our lives because we're afraid of what could be behind the door? Instead of many times what is behind the door is something much bigger than you could have ever imagined on the good side. So how many times have you been faced, maybe not such in a dramatic way, but the opportunity that you have forfeited because you've chosen not to open that particular door? Turn with me over to Matthew chapter 26. Matthew chapter 26 in the Message paraphrase, which is paraphrased, I'll say very loosely on this story. But in Matthew chapter 26, starting in verse number 36, it says, "Then Jesus went with them to a garden called Gethsemane and told his disciples, 'Stay here while I go over there and pray. Take along Peter and the two sons of Zebedee.'" And he plunged into, this paraphrase says, "agonizing sorrow. Then he said, 'This sorrow is crushing my life out. Stay here and keep vigil with me.' Going on a little ahead, he fell on his face praying, 'My Father, if there is any way, get me out of this, but please, not what I want. You, what do you want?'" Another text or another translation called the New American Standard Translation in verse 39 says, "And he went a little beyond them and fell on his face and prayed, saying, 'My Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Yet not as I will, but as you will.'" If you go down to verse 42, again, this paraphrase says, My Father, if there is no way than this, drinking this cup, I'm ready, do it your way. And there's times when I think that you and I face terrorizing challenges, a terrorizing calling, if you will, in quotes, or a terrorizing task that we know that we need to do, but Jesus in this story had to face this task to fulfill his destiny, to fulfill why he was born. Now, I'm not suggesting that any of us have ever had a fear remotely close to being crucified, because crucifixion is a horrible, horrible way to be killed. I'm not suggesting that at all. I am suggesting, in a relative term, that we have been faced with similar fears and anxieties that we have really been tempted to run from because they looked scary at the time. These days, there are many excuses that people use to run from what they're supposed to do. Let me just share two of them. The first one is, it's too late for me. It's too late for me. I can go down a road on that. And second is kind of like a cousin to it, is I'm not good enough. How many people have you met in your employment that have been your bosses that they're about as dumb as dishwater, but they stuck with their careers long enough and did what they had to do long enough to reach a level or a plateau in your employment situation where they're in a position that they're in because they chose not to believe maybe the temptation that they're too old or they're not good enough, et cetera, et cetera. The natural urge for us is to stay out of harm's way. I mean, when you hear bullets flying or when you hear, you know, wheels screech, the first temptation that you and I have is to run away from it because you perceive what? You perceive danger. So the natural urge for us is to assume that the unknown is bad. Again, the natural urge for all of us, or at least most of us, is to assume that the unknown is something negative, is something that we may not want to embrace. So imagine growing up in an environment when your family has ruled an area of thousands of miles for at least hundreds of years, maybe more than hundreds of years. Then imagine one day you felt the need to free these people in your family that were in slavery. And the enormity of such an idea can be, by some standards, can be viewed as egotistical and or ridiculous, because you see people hurting and you want to do something about that hurt. So this is exactly what happened to a man in the Old Testament by the name of Moses. And in order to accomplish this huge task, Moses had to be all in. And I think we've heard that term once or twice in our lives. To be all in means that you can leave nothing on the table. You have to take it all. You have to do everything you can do if you want to accomplish these big tasks. So I want to jump around the story. Just skip over the story just a little bit. Excuse one that Moses had was that he wasn't good enough. In Exodus chapter 3, it says, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt?" His immediate response was, "Who am I? I'm really nobody. So I mean, what credentials do I have that suggest that I'm good enough?" Moses felt overwhelmed by the responsibility. How many times have it you and I felt overwhelmed by a responsibility, or I'll even use a religious word, a calling, that maybe it is too much for us to embrace? I've, in a silly example, I've seen these TV shows of these guys who on these food channel shows that they create, and other people create, these hamburgers that are, you know, inches high, 6 inches high. I'm thinking, how can any human being get their mouth? You can't dislodge your jaw like some animals do and get your... The point is, sometimes you and I look at opportunities as an impossible task because we can't see us getting ourselves around that opportunity. But that wasn't the case 40 years earlier in Moses' life. But he feels like the job is too much to handle. How many times haven't you felt the job is too much to handle in your own life? Because in Moses' case, he jumped the gun, and I'll use that term loosely, that he jumped the gun and he actually killed a guy because he saw one of his family members being treated in a very, very nasty way. So he decided to take things in his own hands and do something incorrectly. And Moses thought that he was too old. He was basing on his chronological age that he couldn't do certain things. How about the magnitude of the task? You know, the old saying is, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time, right? Also, Moses came up with, you know, I've been rejected before. So if I've been rejected before, that means that I will be rejected again. How many times aren't people that you know, people that I know, afraid to take certain steps because we're afraid of the potential rejection, when in fact sometimes it's not that way at all? Sometimes there's an embracing that happens, but you'll never know for sure if you don't take those steps. And then Moses came up with this concept, I think, that time has passed so much that the culture in Egypt had changed. So how dare I go forward? So excuse number two Moses had, of course he had probably hundreds, but number two I want to share today, is that he said, I don't have all the answers. In Exodus 3:13, it said, then Moses said to God, indeed, when I come to the children of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, I'm in Exodus 3:13, and they say to me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? So the answer directly, or at least the question that Moses had to God, because it was God telling Moses that he should do these things, he's like, I don't have all the answers. And I think you and I have fallen into that situation in much, much smaller ways, mind you, that because we don't have all the answers on the front end of a huge opportunity means that we're going to wait until we have all the answers before we embrace the opportunity. So decades pass, time passes, and we never fully embrace the opportunity, because you never really, if you think about it through history, you never really have all the answers before walking through the door. You get the answers as you walk through the door. At least that's been my experience. Excuse number three, people won't believe me, over in Exodus 4:1. Then Moses answered and said, but suppose they will not believe me or listen to my voice. Suppose they say, the Lord has not appeared to you. So again, how many times haven't you come up with that what if question? What if this happens? What if this blows up? What if this person doesn't trust me? What if this relationship falls apart because I choose to take certain steps in certain ways? That what ifs can keep you hunkered down for the rest of your life. Excuse number four. I love number four. I'm a terrible public speaker. Moses had a legitimate excuse. Exodus 4:10. Then Moses said to the Lord, O Lord, I am not eloquent, neither before or since you have spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and slow of tongue. Legitimate excuse. But excuses don't cut it when you have a calling to do a certain thing that's bigger than you. In fact, I would say more times than not that callings are bigger than you. Because if it wasn't a calling, then it wouldn't be very big, if that makes any sense. Number five, he says in Exodus 4:13, he says, I'm not qualified. But he said, oh Lord, please send by the hand of whomever else you may send. Certainly there's other people that are more qualified than me to do this task. That's what Moses was saying. And I wonder how many of us have said the same thing over the years, that please pick somebody else more qualified than me, because certainly there's way smarter people on the planet than me. And I've run into that situation in my own mind multiple times. But I'll loosely quote a guy that's been around for decades. His name's Art. He said, in paraphrase, he said, the smart people never get around to doing nothing, his words. And I wonder how many of us, let me say it a different way, I wonder how many people that we know are so smart that they never get around to doing nothing. And the English is not very, very correct there, obviously. But the point is, sometimes those of us who know that we don't know, we're the ones who get stuff done because we want to know. So the people who think they know, who really don't know, don't get a whole lot done. Did you ever notice in your life that you make excuses when you don't want to do something? Again, have you ever noticed that you make excuses in your life when you really don't want to do something? And I've noticed it in my own family, in my own kids. Holy bologna and cheese. Man, when they really want to do something, they'll find a way. Whether it's get the room cleaned up, spotless, I mean down to the dust, there's no dust in the room, the clothes are picked up, you know, laundry's all caught up, and the whole because their why is so big, because they want to go to the here, they want to run here, they want to be involved in this activity. Why? Because they found they want to do it so bad. So I suggest, at least in my world, that if you want to do something bad enough, you tend to find a way to do it. If not, you find an excuse why you don't want to do it. A guy named Tyler writes, little 11-year-old James had a big, very, very impractical idea. He was going to graduate from high school, but before you dismiss what would seem a pretty average accomplishment for most kids, James lived in a rural, war-torn Uganda. He lost his entire family to disease by the time he was 6 years old and was raised by his poor grandmother, who didn't earn enough for the $130 quarter tuition. A high school diploma was not in the cards for James, and you could hardly blame him if he saw his goal was impossible and gave up to go to work in the fields. But he didn't, you see. Instead, he and his grandmother devised a crazy plan that would secure the financing he needed to finish school. All he needed to start was a goat to sell. His grandmother was able to sell one of hers, and with the proceeds, James was able to buy shoes, a change of clothes, and a ticket for an 8-hour bus ride to the capital where he'd stay with his aunt. That's where the plan gets really interesting. To get the money necessary for school, he needed to sneak into the president's compound and ask for help. He'd have to scale a barbed wire fence and get past the armed security guards, but once inside, he learned, he'd be greeted warmly and given money for tuition. So that's exactly what he did. To everyone's amazement, it worked. So today, at age 32, James has 2 master's degrees and a great job. Making excuses, Tyler writes, and giving up what would have been easy, the hurdles between 11-year-old James and James of today were immense. But something deep inside him compelled him to take responsibility for his life and do whatever it took to realize his goal. So at age 11, James had mastered his psychology and brought his dreams to life. His story is heroic, but it's also well explained by science. Regardless of your situation in life, there's a direct link, listen, between the excuses you make for yourself and how much success you achieve. Moses had a list of excuses, and I would say legitimate excuses, because of the fact of the task that he had to undertake. Tyler goes on to write, if you have big plans for yourself, but you see immense hurdles in front of you, you'll need to learn to be like James. The old saying is, where there's a will, there's a way. If you really want to do something bad enough, you will find a way. So God anointed or chose Aaron, if you will, to go with Moses in this story in Exodus to help be the spokesman. But still, it was not very easy. And the story goes on and on about the 10 plagues and all this stuff. So a whole lot of stuff happened in between, right? So the message and the methods that God has chosen to use through the centuries, I don't think I'll ever get my head around it completely. Because in my little finite brain, it doesn't make sense all the time. But yet the end result, if you look at the end of the story, you see now why certain things happened in a certain order that you would not have probably chosen. So eventually, and with great reluctance, Moses took a role of the one that would lead the slaves out of Egypt. I would say, and I would even guess, that the people that really don't want to lead tend to be the more productive people on the planet, because they're not in it for the ego, they're not in it for the title. And when you have to be talked into something, and then once you embrace the something, man, there's nothing that can stop you. But oftentimes we need to take, sometimes we, as in some people, some of us need to be talked into something for quite a number of years. Oftentimes, listen, oftentimes stubbornness is a mask for fear. Think about that. Stubbornness, many times, is a mask for fear. Seth Godin writes, what we need to do is say, quote, what's the smartest, tiniest thing I can master? And what's the scariest thing I can do in front of the smallest number of people that can teach me how to dance with the fear? Think about that a minute. Once you get good at it, we just realize, he says, that it's not fatal. And it's not intellectually realized. We've lived in something that wasn't fatal. And that idea is what's so key, because then you can do it a little bit more. How many times haven't you, when, if you can remember back that far, when you first started to try to ride a bicycle, you know, you didn't probably succeed on the first try. Certainly you don't remember when you started to walk. Well, you fell down more times than you walked for a little while. But eventually, obviously, you got a whole lot easier. T.D. Jakes said, look, you might want to write this one down because he's way smarter than me. T.D. Jakes says, if you run after your destiny, write it down, if you run after your destiny, you'll escape your history. Again, if you run after your destiny, you'll escape your history. So the fear of falling on your face, listen, has kept millions of people from going back and facing their destiny and their fears. The fear of falling on your face has kept millions of people from realizing why they were born in the first place. And there was a gentleman who was our contractor. I don't know if I shared this yet here, for our home. And his name was Bob Thomas, and Bob Thomas passed away in the last couple of weeks. And the kids used to call him Bob the Builder, of course, because he was at our house quite often, and he was the contractor for the house. But it would have been very easy for Bob to cut corners and realize a higher profit in our house. But if I go through the house now, we've been in there 9 or 10 years now, but I go around the house and I see that Bob did not cut corners. He could have, you know, spaced certain things wider that he didn't have to buy as much wood, but he didn't do that. The point is, when he did stuff right, then his legacy lives on because of the quality of his work. And I think so many of us forget that even though sometimes that what we see today doesn't matter today, it matters down the road a ways when people look back and say, you know what, this person did it for the right reason. They did it with integrity. They did it with excellence. Stephen Pressfield wrote in a book called The War of Art, he says, are you paralyzed with fear? He said, that's a good sign. He said, fear is good. Fear is good. He says, like self-doubt, fear is an indicator. Fear tells us what we have to do. Again, it's a spin on fear. Again, fear tells us what we have to do. Remember our rule of thumb, he says. The more scared we are of a work or a calling, the more sure we can be that we have to do it. He says, resistance is experienced as fear. The degree of fear equates the strength of resistance. So the more fearful you are, the more resistant you are to doing the things that you are afraid of doing. I could share several examples there. He says, therefore, the more we feel about a specific enterprise, the more certain we can be that that enterprise is important to us and to the growth of our soul. These are his words. So the thing that you're most fearful of, for some of us, is something that we may need to embrace. I'll get to that in just a second. Tina Esmaker writes, when you're thinking about doing something and it feels scary, when it feels like this big lion is waiting at the finish line and he's roaring and he's ferocious and he's going to tear you apart, she says, you should run toward the lion anyway. I read online that there's a brown bear that is within about a half an hour of our house now, maybe 40 minutes of our house. And 40 minutes, half an hour to a bear, they can do that overnight. So they could be, you know, here. So I reminded Tammy, I says, when if you're home and you're out on a walk, you know, you see the bear, you don't run from the bear. You stand up against the bear. You make a bunch of noise. You put your arms up. You make yourself bigger than the bear. Because when you run from the fear, when you run from the animal, what happens with animals? They then start to, they start to chase. They start to attack. So I wonder how many times in your own life, in my life, when we've run from the fear, the item that we're afraid of seems to get bigger and stronger because they see, or it sees, that you're afraid of what you're trying to accomplish. There's a term that you and I have heard. It's called skin in the game. And one definition is a term coined by renowned investor Warren Buffett, referring, listen, to a situation in which high-ranking insiders use their own money to buy stock in the company they're running, to put skin in the game. So I go back once again to Matthew 26, again, verse number 42. He went away a second time, this is talking about Jesus, went away a second time and prayed, saying, "My Father, if this cannot pass away unless I drink it, your will be done." Verse 43, again he came and found them sleeping, his followers, his chums, his buddies, his disciples, found them sleeping, for their eyes were heavy. And he left them again and went away and prayed a third time, saying the same thing once more. Verse 45, then he came to the disciples and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? Behold, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. Get up, let us be going. Behold, the one who betrays me is at hand," which we're talking now about Judas. I can only share this from my point of view, but nobody knows your journey like you know your journey. As much as you try to explain it, even the closest people to you don't know your journey. They don't know your fight. They don't know what you've had to overcome to get to this point in your life because they haven't been joined with you at the hip. Do they love you? Of course. Do they care about you? Yes. But they don't really understand. The disciples, they walked with Jesus. They hung around Jesus. They were his twin, in quotes, for a few years. And they still didn't get the enormity of what Jesus was about to face, even though he dropped little seeds about it. He dropped little hints about it, but some of us, maybe we would have been the same way. I don't know. Some things we just don't catch because, listen, we're not walking in the shoes of the people to whom they're dropping the seeds. You understand what I'm saying here. So there's a book out called We Bought a Zoo, and by Benjamin Mee. And in this book, there's a short quote. He says, "You know, sometimes all you need is 20 seconds of insane courage. 20 seconds of insane courage. Just literally 20 seconds of just embarrassing bravery, and I promise you, something great will come of it." I was at the gym on the bike, let's say a month ago. I was up to maybe 4 miles, and I'm on the bike, and a guy had come over to me, and he was one of the people that came to me and said, "I saw you on TV, and your sermon really helped me, blah, blah." And he says, "What are you doing now? What project are you working on now?" And I had an idea of a talk show that I wanted to do back here that was back here. It wasn't out here yet. It was in writing, but it wasn't, I didn't publicize it. So I had about 20 seconds while I'm pedaling, while I'm getting close to the end of my bike ride, to either lie and say, "Nothing really, you know, everything's about the same," or hang myself by my words. This is going back about a month ago. So I told him, I says, "Well, I'm in the early stages of developing a TV talk show." And then it was out. So either, as I shared this years ago, either I'm going to be a liar or I'm either going to be a buyer. The old quote is, that is, either I'm going to not follow through with what I said I'm going to follow through with, or I'm going to follow through with what I said I'm going to follow through with. So now that the point is that experience, that interaction, that 2 minute, 3 minute conversation, now because I don't want to be viewed as a liar, that my why now has gotten so big because I told this individual that this is something I'm working on. So now do I put it on the back burner? I can't. Do I put it in the cupboard and forget about it? I can't now. So once it's out, the point being, sometimes when you share it, sometimes the fear, listen, at least in my own brain, the fear reduces considerably, and then either you're going to do it because you're telling somebody that you're going to do it, or you're really going to be full of hot air and really not really going to follow through on what you said to this individual or these people that you said you're going to do. So yes, to answer your question, is back in, so is it in development? It sure is. It's about 70% ready to go. So in 820 BC, there was a guy named Jonah. And this guy named Jonah was sent by God to warn this city who was full of evil people. But Jonah really wasn't interested. In fact, Jonah, it was pretty intimidating. In fact, it was very intimidating because the way that they treated people that didn't believe the way they believed was dramatic. You think certain groups around the world these days are evil? Well, they were as evil or more. So he had a reason to not be interested. Have y'all ever been not interested in doing something that you feel like you should be doing? Jonah was in that example. Turn to Jonah 3. Living Bible paraphrases it in a pretty easy to understand way. Jonah 3, verse 1. Then the Lord spoke to Jonah again. Now, this is kind of halfway into the story. Jonah said, no, I'm going the other direction. Something came up. He, you know, had time to think about it, and I'll put that in loose terms. He thought about it for a few days. So in Jonah chapter 3, Living Bible says, and the Lord said to Jonah again, go to the great city Nineveh, he said, and warn them of their doom. Listen, as this paraphrase says, as I told you to do before. Pause in my sermon. How many times haven't you told a child? Now, I told you, now, second time, third time, to go. That's another sermon. Verse 3. But listen, now, verse 3. So Jonah obeyed and went to Nineveh. He had a 3-day time out, we'll say. Now, Nineveh was a very large city and many villages around it. So large, it would take 3 days to walk through it. Verse 4. But the very first day when Jonah entered the city and began to preach, listen, let me repeat this and slow it down to half speed. Verse 4. But the very first day that Jonah entered the city and began to preach, the people repented. The very first day. Are you with me? Jonah shouted to the crowds and gathered around him, 40 days from now Nineveh will be destroyed. And they believed him and declared a fast. From the king on down, and everyone put on sackcloth of that time they did that, and the rough, coarse garments worn at time of mourning. Verse 6, for when the king of Nineveh heard what Jonah was saying, listen, he stepped down from his throne. He put on these garments that he was sad and mourning. Verse 7, and the king and his nobles sent the message throughout the city, listen, let no one, not even the animals, eat anything at all or drink any water. Everyone must wear the sackcloth and listen and cry mightily to God. Everyone turn from their evil ways, from his violence and robbing. So the long and short of the story is that what if Jonah would have gone immediately and done what he was supposed to do the first time, knowing that God had prepared the hearts of the people and the minds of the people, that he didn't have to go through all this stuff, this arguing and this timeout stuff, you know, because the way was made clear. The whole point is, oftentimes when we're, I hate to use the religious term, but when we feel called to do something, don't you think that there's a purpose behind you being called? And the calling wouldn't have happened if there wasn't some sort of pre-preparation that went into the calling before you knew that it was a calling, if that makes any sense at all. Write this down. This is a quote from a guy much less famous than T.D. Jakes. His name is John Carver, okay? way less. No, I don't even hold a candle to Bishop Jakes. But write this down. The volume of the sounds of your excuses, the volume of the sounds of your excuses must not be louder than the call of your destiny. Again, the volume of the sounds of your excuses must not be louder than the call of your destiny. I wonder how many of us choose to invest more time allowing the excuses to be played over and over and over in our minds that keep us from going down certain paths. Let me chase a minor detour here. In my world, in my brain, I have to be very careful what music I allow to be played near me. As an example, for the last 2 days, in my head, I've been having the song, Play That Funky Music, White Boy. That song has been going over and over in my head for 2 days, and I cannot get that funky music playing White Boy in, out of my head. You know, I have no idea why I heard it. I maybe heard it in a store. Maybe I heard it. I don't play that on the radio because I just explained why. But the point is, once you get this stuff in your head, stuff, whatever that stuff is, the excuses in this example, then it takes a tremendous amount of effort for you on the back end to readjust what's going on in your head. So why not do it on the front end? To be very careful what you allow going into your eyes, your ears, you know, your mind, so that when the time comes for you to embrace the calling or a mission or a new opportunity, you don't have all the baggage and all the stuff in my mind, the music that is distracting you from doing the things that you need to be doing anyway. If it makes any sense at all. What if Jonah would have absolutely refused to go back and faced his destiny? The answer is more than 120,000 people would have died. So if you don't think that your calling or your mission or your undertaking or your passion to do a certain thing means anything to somebody other than you, then I have to tell you that you're wrong. Because you don't know what your life, you don't know what your words, your actions, your music, whatever adjective you choose to use here, is going to mean to people, but it's not going to mean anything to people if you keep running in the opposite direction of doing the thing that you're supposed to be doing. What if you and I have missed opportunities to save thousands of people's lives because we refuse to go back and face our destiny? You know, I think, and again, this is just my own opinion here, but I think there's going to come a time in our lives that we're going to be held accountable for the people that we have chosen not to make a difference in their lives by default, by what we choose not to do daily, because we allow all the things I've shared so far, the fear and the intimidation and all that, to stop us, and the excuses to stop us from doing the things that we should be doing. But sometimes, as I shared earlier, that we think we're not good enough, or we're not smart enough, or we don't have enough time, or we don't have enough money, or we don't have enough influence, whatever other excuse that you choose to come up with. Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote, "When a resolute young fellow steps up to the great bully, listen, the world, and takes him boldly by the beard, he is often surprised to find it comes off in his hand, and that it was only tied on to scare away the timid adventurers." How many people in your own life have you met at work that came across as all this and all that, but when you really got to know them, they're just hurting people, and they have a mask, they have a facade, that's not really them, but nobody else has taken the time, has invested the time to get to know the person, to find out why they're angry and why they're fearful, why they're always negative, or they're always pick, when you really didn't, or other people didn't take the time to see what's behind the beard. Because once you see behind the beard, now it all makes sense. Do you understand? Arson Sweat Martin, I have about 4 or 5 of his original books. They were written 100 plus years ago. He says, one thing he said is, when we are sure that we are on the right road, there is no need to plan our journey too far ahead. No need to burden ourselves with doubts and fears as to the obstacles that may bar our progress. he ends with, we cannot take more than one step at a time. Because when you start borrowing what could be, and what twists and turns could be coming down the road, or what difficulties you might face, then that list is now longer, if you dwell on it too much, that's going to stop you from even getting started, because you come up with this list of what could be's. Turn over, if you will, over to James chapter 2. James chapter 2, I think, makes it, I think, relatively clear. James 2, starting in verse 14, says, what good is it, my brothers, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can that faith save him? If a brother or sister is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warm and filled, without giving them the things needed for the body, what good is that? So also, faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. Oh, I want to share an example, but it might be so crude. I don't want to do that. But the point is, sometimes you have to either do it, you have to either speak up or shut up, is, I think, my paraphrase here. Because saying a bunch of stuff without doing a bunch of stuff, it doesn't turn into anything, is what I'm saying. Skip down to verse 18 in James 2. Show me your faith apart from your works, and I will show you my faith, what's it say, by my works. You believe that God is one, you do well. Even the demons believe and shudder. Do you want them to be shown, you foolish person, that faith apart from works is useless? Was not Abraham our father justified by the works when he offered up his son Isaac? And then it goes down through the list. So if you skip down, for as body apart from the spirit is dead, so also is faith apart from works is dead. So the point is, at least in my mind, that you can talk about stuff all day long, that I want to do this, and I want to accomplish this, I want to, you know, change the world, or I want to accomplish certain things at work or in my education or in the family. But when you just talk about it, instead of taking the steps, consistent steps to do it, then nothing really changes at all. There's a connection between doing stuff and stuff getting done. I know this is mind-blowing, but there is a connection of doing stuff and stuff getting done. You can't be talking about it all day and not doing stuff. Harvey McKay shares a story. He says, I've always been a guy raised in the city, and he says, I can't even coax a weed to grow. But I discovered a national treasure practically in my own backyard, which made me wish my thumbs were greener. Donna Fran's greatest skill is not really the organic farming that has dominated her life for the last 16 years, but at age 81, she's not about to stop learning and doing things. You read that right, age 81. Donna and her husband, Leon, started a seasonal farmer's market that eventually grew year-round to a florist and a gift shop that they've operated for 21 years. So at age 65, when most folks are seriously contemplating retirement, they moved to the farm, her 25 acres of gold. As long as she can physically work the farm and her mind stays sharp, there is no desire to retire. The soil around this place in Minnesota is rich and black and perfect for my lifelong dream to grow and share these fabulous vegetables with people, she says. The produce is picked daily and washed and brought in the lower level, and she goes on to describe it. The point is, she shared about her work ethic, that she could have talked all day about wanting to do this, but then even at age 81, she says, I'm going to do what I feel that I need to do for my calling. So there's a tendency, I think, for you and I to put off stuff, and then you look back and you're still putting off stuff now 20, 30, 40, 50 years later, if you're older than 50. You know, you keep putting stuff off. Even teenagers, let's just break down the smaller increments. Months, you put stuff off for months. When now months turn into years, and if you're around long enough, years turn into decades. So there's a tendency for your bad memories to be blown up. Have you ever told the story about some problems that you've had years ago, and you've noticed that those problems got really big as the years went by? That fish story got bigger, or that, oh man, I used to walk to school in the snow uphill both ways. I mean, that's a crazy example. But you know, as time goes on, unless you deal with these issues earlier than later, they do get bigger. So you got to be careful on that. A.A.W. Tozer writes, "The devil wants you to live in a state of discouraged chagrin and remorse." A.W. Tozer, great author that lived a long time ago. He said, "Remember, the Bible does not teach that if a man falls down, he can never rise again. The fact that he falls, listen, is not the most important thing, but rather that he is forgiven and allows God to lift him up." So many times we keep looking back and referring to our mistakes. There's times I go down the road and I find myself shaking my head because I'm thinking about stupid stuff I did 30 years ago. 35 years ago. Stupid. Why am I still thinking about stupid stuff that I've done 35 years ago? Shouldn't that be like done? Shouldn't I be over it? Shouldn't you be over that stuff? So one of the biggest lies you can believe is it's too late for me. I mean, all of us have said it at some point, no matter what your age, it's too late for me. It's not too late for it. Well, it is too late for you if you're not breathing anymore, then it's too late. But if you're still breathing, then it's not too late. Simon writes, "Unsuccessful people," listen, I love this because I was there for so many years. "Unsuccessful people in life are mood," M-O-O-D, "dominated." Unsuccessful people are mood dominated. In other words, I don't feel like working today. That's why I said earlier, for years here, that you got to have a to-do list. If you don't have a to-do list that gets you going in your day, you write it the night before, just so for those who haven't heard it, write it the night before so you get up in the morning with something to do, whether it's work, whether it's after work, whatever it is, write it down. Again, that's another sermon. Turn to 1 Timothy chapter 4. 1 Timothy chapter 4. Timothy was a younger man, and I'm not even talking 20s. In that culture, if you were not 40 years old yet, you were not considered as somebody very wise. Okay? So according to my studies, Timothy wasn't 40 yet. 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse number 11, starting there, it says, this is Paul, the great Paul, the great teacher Paul, was trying to give advice to the younger man, younger than 40 years old, Timothy. He says, "Prescribe and teach these things," now verse 12, "let no man look down on your youthfulness, but rather in speech, conduct, in love, in faith, in purity, show yourself an example of those who believe. Until I come again, give attention to the public reading of Scripture, to exhortation, to teaching." But he says, "Do not neglect the spiritual," listen, verse 14, "do not neglect the spiritual gift within you, which was bestowed on you through prophetic utterance with the laying on of hands by the presbytery." Verse 15, "take hands with these things, be absorbed in them, so that your progress will be evident to all." Now, if you just pick out these two verses or three verses here, to me it suggests that Timothy had to be proactive in developing the gifts or the callings that he was given. When you and I choose not to develop the callings and gifts that we were born with or that we've been developed into over a period of time, something happens. It's called apathy. It's called when you start depleting the strength that you've had because you. In fact, I was sick for, I don't know, a few days, a month or two ago, and I was out of the gym for like 4 days, just four or five days. And man, going back to the gym after 4 or 5 days, I could really tell. I had to work back up. It was ridiculously frustrating because those 4 or 5 days. The point is, Paul is telling Timothy here that when you neglect your gift, something happens. Something that is good is not good is going to happen. That is, you're going to start falling and getting weaker. Because Timothy must have been stumbling over, if you will, his lack of experience, or his age, or any combination that thereof. Paul again was reminding Timothy that it was up to him. Verse 14, "don't neglect the spiritual gift within you," and he goes on to say how he got it. Verse 15, "take pains with these things, be absorbed in them," it says, so that your progress will be evident to all. So some of us have said, well, I can't evolve, I can't get stronger, I can't get smarter because there are not enough people around me to help me get there. That's not what I'm reading here in this text. Paul is being very direct that it's up to Timothy to get better so that his progress, in quotes, will be evident to all. In fact, some of these people that Paul was talking to Timothy about was some of the people that Paul taught. And now Paul is going away for a time. Now Timothy's substituting Paul for a time. So imagine the intimidation factor that Timothy must have been facing. Whoa, wait a minute. Paul taught these people who know a whole lot more than I do, in quotes. And now I'm going to come up and substitute for Paul. I had an experience a couple months ago. I was asked to substitute a class for a religion teacher. And this guy's got a doctorate degree in religion and stuff. And so on the to-do list, the teacher left me. He says, well, you can talk about this. You know, let's just use an extreme example, you know, the deep things about Daniel and prophecy. Or you can talk about this. Well, I didn't know until I got into the classroom that he was going to ask me to do the deep things of Daniel prophecy. So what path did I choose to take? I took this path, which was something that I knew. Because I knew that if I would have started sharing and blabbing about stuff that I didn't prepare for, the point here is that Paul was encouraging Timothy to always be prepared, always to keep better, always to keep tweaking yourself and self-developing yourself. Over in 1 Timothy 1, verse 3 and 4, one paraphrase says, again, 1 Timothy 1, 3 and 4, as I urged you when I was going to Macedonia, remain in Ephesus that you may charge certain persons not to teach any different doctrine, nor occupy themselves with myths and endless genealogies, which promote speculations rather than the divine training that's in the faith. So there are people in your life and my life that are investing in stuff and doing things and spending time on stuff that really don't matter. So three chapters later, we see Paul, I'll say it four or five times, that Paul was telling Timothy, this is what you need to focus on. Focus on developing yourself and getting better so that you can be viewed as doing well by all. Again, as you know, I look for examples all the time about how to reaffirm in a different frame the theme that I'm sharing. So I read a story about Steve Harvey. Steve Harvey, TV talk show host, entertainer, comedian, making millions upon millions upon millions of dollars. But the story shares, Steve Harvey recalled a very painful experience of becoming homeless following his first divorce while he was pursuing a career in comedy. Harvey was living out of his car at the time and making $50 a week. All I knew that I could make people laugh, he told this magazine. Harvey shared, the moment he hit rock bottom, he says, quote, I sat down and started crying, but a voice said, if you keep going, listen, I'm going to take you places you've never been. He said, it was like God said, don't quit, you're almost there. So after 3 years of struggling, Harvey pulled out of homelessness and landed his first major gig in 1993 as the host of what? Showtime at the Apollo, if you've ever seen it. Which led to his comedy television series, The Steve Harvey Show, in 1996. Since then, he's been very successful, and he now hosts his own daytime show. And if you've never seen him on Family Feud, you haven't seen Family Feud yet. You know, he did the Miss Universe, which we understand what happened there. But, you know, it's all good. We can make a mistake once in a blue moon. As the article ends with, as he strives to become his words are, the smartest working man in show business, he says, he ends the story with, I'm running from homelessness. If you really look down at the core, at the heartbeat of people who have really overcome something, I'd say more than half of them are running from something that they don't want to go back to. And let me digress for just a second or two, that also some of the people that you're dealing with in your own life react in certain ways because they're running from things that they don't want to face that they've had to deal with years ago. That's another sermon of another theme. In one interview, Steve Harvey says, in quotes, I'm almost done, I've lost it all twice and I've had to start over. I had to struggle through two marriages before finding this one. I didn't have nothing. He says, in every single moment of adversity in your life, he says, two things are going to happen. There's going to be a lesson and there's going to be a blessing. If you let the adversary crumble you, he says, you will lay there and wallow in the failure, but life is 10% what happened and 90% what you're going to do about it. What are you going to do about it? Christina Rossetti writes, can anything be sadder than work left unfinished? Yes, work never begun. That's even sadder. So I end today with, it's never too late to go back and do what you were born to accomplish. So you have to go back and face it. And do like what Paul encouraged Timothy to do. My paraphrase, if it's to be, it's up to me. You can't rely. Paul was trying to tell Timothy in this story that Timothy could not rely on anybody to develop himself besides himself. If that didn't jump out at you, that's what Paul was telling Timothy. You have to develop yourself if you want to be viewed in the people that Timothy was going to lead as somebody who knew what he was talking about. So whatever you're facing, whatever you're struggling with, go back and face it, deal with it, overcome it, and leverage it as a step up instead of a step down. I want to share some exciting news. My fourth book came out late last year called Build Your Foundation, 68 Building Blocks for a Successful and Rewarding Life. You can get a copy of it over at TremendousLifeBooks.com. Again, TremendousLifeBooks.com. It's jam-packed full of information that will help you and your family. Here's some more information about it. For the last 25 years, I've visited with thousands of people in their homes. Many of these people I've met with have no goals, no dreams, no ambitions, and no roadmap for their life. I've seen so many people sitting on their front porches watching life go by. In 2006, my wife and I started building our home with bedrooms for each of our six kids. I always made sure that the foundation of our home was solid. I didn't want to take any chances with the lives of my family. So it is with life. My book, Build Your Foundation, 68 Building Blocks of a Successful, Rewarding Life, is jammed full of ideas that can help you today. My book is a collection of ideas and short stories really designed to help you turn your life around and to help impact the people that you care about and that you love so much. Whether you're just beginning to lay your foundation or you've already built your life but need to shore up some weak spots, Build Your Foundation will help you fortify yourself for a lifetime of success and to give you the courage to go for your dreams in life. Don't miss out on what you can accomplish. You can scale any height and achieve any goal. This book will help you get there. I have a passion to help millions of people change their lives. This book is easy to read, has short chapters, and can help you right now and change your life today. I believe in you. Thank you so much for listening to The John Carver Show. If you want more information about me, just simply go to my website, www.johnwcarver.com. Again, thanks so much for listening to the show today, and remember, I believe in you.
For listening to The John Carver Show. Please tune in again right here Monday through Friday for more insights and opinions on how you can reach your goals and dreams in life.